Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
The passion for storytelling is alive and well, and we want to encourage and promote the incredible work of authors who have chosen to publish their books independently. We hope to encourage creativity and innovation in the literary world by helping these books sell, which is what everyone wants. Not my words, but the words of one of our awesome guests today. That's Sandy Lawrence. How are you, Sandy?
I'm great, Alex. Thank you. Thanks for inviting us.
Well, it's great to have you on board because you've also got another fabulous soul with us as well to talk about the Fire Book Awards. That's the wonderful Rita Mills. How are you, Rita?
Good. How about yourself?
Yeah, okay. All things considered. It's a nice Houston welcome we're getting there, which is always great. Sandy, we'll come to you first because this is a really exciting project for the talent of tomorrow, the talent of today in many ways, who are just waiting for the world to discover them tomorrow. And it's all about the whole notion of the Embers Book Awards, the Fire and Embers Book Awards. So what prompted you to actually say, yeah, this is what we need to do. The world needs this, Sandy.
You know, what prompted me was Rita Mills. Rita and I have both been retired for a couple of years. And she said, I've got an idea for a project. And are you interested? And I'm like, absolutely. So Rita, I met Rita when I first started a business as a publicist, and she taught me everything I know. So she's the one that had this idea, and I'm just very happy to have something to do during retirement that includes helping Rita with another project. And this project, the Fire Book Awards, and I'll let her tell you about the name, but our goal is to honor and recognize authors who choose to go the self-publishing or the independent publishing route and who do quality work, but sometimes, as you said, don't sell a lot of books or don't get a lot of recognition for it. So that's our goal, to change the whole publishing landscape.
So Rita, it's all your fault, as Sandy's just said, in terms of the line of that. So a nice passing of the baton there. Was this something which, again, you'd always had a passion for? And did you feel that actually when it comes to self-published authors, that actually there is a huge area that needs to be celebrated there?
Well, books saved my life growing up. If it hadn't have been for the library, where I could go check out Nancy Drew mysteries, I don't know what I would have done. But Sandy's blaming it all on me, but she's part of it. We're both retired, or were. And I told her I was just bored to death. And you know how I get when I get bored, I get in trouble generally. And she said, well, what kind of trouble are you in this time? So I explained what I wanted to do, or my idea, and she helped me hone it. And our other two partners involved in this, Amy Ravichandran, did I pronounce that right?
You did. You did good.
And Dina Schoenfeld. Help, you know, we all pitched in and gave our advice, and with all of our varied background, we hope we have a winner.
I maybe cancel background noise. Anyway.
Sorry, we had a little sort of insertion there from Jessica Virtus, who's currently on tour. She's normally based in North Carolina, but I think she's been sort of heading off to Europe. She's in France and all sorts of things. And also, I think, will be a key soul in terms of this. Again, now, when she actually unmutes herself and gets the background noise sorted out, which is great there. But you're quite right,
Hello?
Rita. There, you're great. You're fine, Jessica. This is good. So all's well.
Sorry, I thought I was unmuted. I'm sorry, I muted. I thought I was muted. My bad.
As Sandy and Rita will attest to, whether you're muted or unmuted can be a whole exercise in itself, really, which is great.
That's
stuff.
That's true.
I mean, the decision to do this seems as though it's almost a no-brainer. Any reason why it hasn't been done before? Because obviously there is that big Jeff Bezos organization that obviously encourages self-publication through, it's obviously named after a river in the South Americas. But in terms of that, is there a sort of area that, yeah, that's one thing, but fundamentally, as you said, audiences which might be limited for niche marketing books, or just people who literally have, you know, basically poured their heart and soul into a book, and they wanted to actually have it published. Was that part of the idea behind it?
Part of it is indie publishing, and indie publishing has come a long way since the early 90s when I got involved in actual book publishing. And the quality is there. If a person wants to indie publish and they've got, you know, the right editor to help them out and the right packager to help them put together the project so it can stand next to anything on a bookshelf, then they've got the opportunity to have a New York Times bestseller if they can get the marketing. And the marketing is the key to anything that's indie published, and that's what's lacking. Well, part of our reason for doing this, and there are a lot of book awards out there, but their main focus is taking a look at the books, writing a brief critique about it, and then, you know, posting the books. Well, they don't help try and sell the product. And that's what there's two unique things about this book award. One is the fact that we help market and sell product, and anybody who writes a book wants that. And the second aspect is it's unique in that we are taking the top books, posting them online, doing a American Idol type internet vote, and the one who wins the internet vote, who gets the most votes, gets the big grand prize money, which is $1,500.
I don't know. Did they know about American Idol in England?
I think you might find that Simon Cowell, responsible for American Idol, started it all off on this side of the Atlantic.
Yeah, I thought it started on that side of the pond.
When you say that, basically, do we know about it? Yes, know about it and have suffered through it in various ways. But that's another line entirely for a different era. And let's face it, no American Idol, what would have happened to Kelly Clarkson's career? Could have gone completely down.
That's true, so. And she's awesome.
Well, there you go. So again, if we can turn this to Sandy, this sounds really exciting. It's the first year that this has actually operated. It launches, as I say, literally in May. Is there a sense of anticipation, excitement, fear? What's the sort of, or all three?
Oh my gosh, yes, of course there is. I mean, I'm just having a blast writing the press releases and doing the marketing for the Fire Awards themselves, and to get the message out that our goal is to help you market your book. So if you submit a book to the awards, and we've got judges that are completely non-partial, and the book will be judged completely on its content first and then the packaging. And so does it look like a book that was published by Random House or one of the top publishing companies? I don't know the top publishing firm in England. So
because we could have Bloomsbury, we could have Penguin, we could have all sorts of other areas.
Right. Okay. So Penguin, okay, we recognize that name. So does your book on a shelf in a bookstore, does it compare and equal to? Because if it does, then it deserves the same attention and the same recognition.
Exactly.
And so that's our goal, and to market that so that other people who don't want to wait the time or don't have the time to wait on getting an agent and going through that entire process, then they have an option, a very viable option, of producing a quality book equal to that of the big house. So that's our goal. And that's been our goal from the beginning, wasn't it, Rito? Even when we did not have an award, our goal of the books that we worked with, the authors that we supported, and I supported them from a PR marketing. She did the book packaging and putting that quality product together. And we wanted to be able to put that book next to any other book and have it come out absolutely looking great.
And in terms of the actual criteria, because clearly a novella could be seen as anything which is under 100,000 words, a book can be, you know, 200,000 plus, etc. Are there any particular criteria that you've actually got? I mean, we could have a book of poetry, presumably, could be entered.
Yes, poetry can be entered. We haven't set a maximum number. You know, there are a lot of people that have, like you said, novellas that are way up there in the page count. But we have set a minimum, and I can't remember what it is now, but I think it's
But that 15, information's 000. On our website, Rita, so we want to make sure we tell people how to go get all the details.
Exactly. And they're all on there, so...
Well, let's mention the website now. We'll mention it, of course, again at the end. Where is the best place to go to find out further details?
Go to www.fire, FIRE, book awards with an S on the end of it.com.
Excellent. Jessica, you know as well as I do that since you are an undergraduate and now you're a postgraduate and you've done your master's degree in children's literature, that we believe that North Carolina requires an author to write the great American novel. So you may not have actually completed it as yet, but do you have any questions for either Rita or Sandy about these independent awards for the book publishing world?
I do. Well, I find book awards very fascinating, and I'm really curious about how you define quality, because you were saying that kind of trying to find books that could match up to books published by a big publishing house. So how do you define quality? Because you mentioned aesthetics as well. So I was curious about your personal definition for that.
That's a great question. Thank you, Jessica. And Rita, I think you're the best one, since you were the one that did the packaging of the quality books that we represented. So why don't you tell us what we're looking for?
Actually, I used to be at the University of Houston at a publishing house called Arte Publico Press. And they were, or I'm assuming they still are, the largest publisher of Hispanic literature in the United States. And my main job when I first started there was launching a children's picture book imprint, and it's called Piñata Books, and they're bilingual books, English and Spanish. And they have sold a lot of sub rights around the world, not just, you know, English and Spanish. But from there, when I started packaging product, I left there in 96, I was specializing in children's picture books. So it's kind of ironic that that's kind of what your focus is, Jessica. But I had a publishing house or a publishing imprint called the ABC's Books, where I think I ended up publishing 6 children's picture books. And of those 6, we had one that topped the 12,000 copies sold list, which is, that's a pretty good track record, you know, for book sales, especially children's books.
But Rita, tell her about the quality that we're looking for in the competition, the Fire Awards.
As far as children's books, if you don't have the quality there, you're not going to get in a bookstore. And for the most part, they want hard copies of books with a jacket on them. But you've got to have quality illustrations. You've got to have a quality print. You've got to have a high opacity on your paper. Most of the 4-color books that I've printed throughout the years have been done in Hong Kong, which is kind of a no-no anymore. I do my 4-color printing in Canada for the most part. But if you don't have the quality on a children's book, you might as well save your money and don't do it.
I mean, clearly there's an awful lot of...
What about books that are not children's books, Rita? I mean, I know we have the judges that are reading the books for the content. Mm-hmm. And then we have someone that's looking at the book cover design and back and all of that. Right. So,
yeah, our judging process has 2 levels. One is the quality of the literary aspect of the project, whether it's a nonfiction book that's about psychology or it's a children's picture book. All of those take a different skill set to judge the quality of them. So we have book judges that have experience in all of those different genres. And I got lost on my track, Sandy. What did I forget to tell?
Well, the quality, the content. So I know there's some questions that they answer that you put together.
the twofold, the quality of the literary aspect, and then the quality of the actual standards that the publishing industry has. And you've got to have the right kind of paper, you know, the right kind of binding, you have to be as good as the book sitting on the shelf next to yours in a bookstore. So we feel like that giving both of those aspects, there may be some books in there that are fabulous reads, are well done as far as the literary aspect of it, but maybe their packaging was not all that great. Well, if we give them input that, you know, their packaging was not all that great, but we love the aspect of the story that you produced, they might go back and do a reprint of that book and, you know, further their actual publishing of that particular book and make it better and make it more, you know, sell more books for more awareness of it.
I'm intrigued by the title, if I may actually come back to the Fire and Embers Book Awards. Now, you could actually see that FIRE could be an acronym for fantastic, innovative, relevant, and educational, if you wish to actually use FIRE in that sort of sense. Or you could actually give it a nod to Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, of course, the notion of burning books and all sorts of other setting fire to books and texts, etc. Was it just a case of you wanted to kind of catch fire in a kind of spirit coming alive format? And why the choice of the word fire for books?
Well, we wanted something that was lively and that would catch fire, you know, basically. The acronym is Fantastic, no, Finest Indie Reading Experience.
Excellent.
So that's what we came up with as far as FIRE. Yeah. And we did a play on the aspect of Prometheus, who brought fire and knowledge to the common man. And that was part of the whole persona of the competition, was Prometheus.
Well, when you bear in mind that Mary Shelley once wrote the Frankenstein novel with the subtitle The Modern Prometheus, you've got a nice sort of relevance there to the early 19th century tying into the 21st century. But yeah. I wonder if Mary Shelley had a time machine, whether she'd actually enter it for time packaging, etc. Maybe that's the subject of a novel. Perhaps I should write it down now. Jessica,
yeah, that's true.
Whereabouts are you? Are you in Cambridge presently, or are you sort of out and about?
I am in Cambridge, so quite the literary town. So plenty of bookshops. Maybe I'll find an independent book somewhere. But I am in Cambridge at the moment.
Excellent.
Or an independent bookstore. Because Saturday in the United States is Independent Bookstore Day. You know, that we have a name for every day of the year, just about. And it's great for PR, because it gives you a reason to send a press release. So we're sending one out that says, help us celebrate the independent bookstores on Saturday. And we have several in the Houston area.
So let's move on. Sorry, Rita, yes?
Yeah, the indie bookstores in the United States are far more user-friendly and geared to the client than, say, Barnes & Noble is. Mm. Most of the people in Barnes & Noble, they don't have a clue about what they're trying to sell. They're just there as sales clerks, basically. But the indie stores, those people that own them are passionate about books, and they probably read the majority of the books that they've got in their store. So we want to promote, independent store bookstores, because they're part of what we are. We're indie too.
And that certainly is at the heart of certainly the case in Britain, where the independent bookseller has had a checkered history over recent years. I mean, they seem to be still hanging on in there, so to speak. But yes, you've got your major chain stores, your Waterstones, etc. And of course, you have the ever-present specter of the internet and the web and issues with respect to that, which is obviously problematic for many bookstores in general. Which brings me to the other thing. Is there a category for ebook publishing in your FIRE Awards?
That's part of the award, but there's not specifically an award for an ebook. You've got to have a printed book in order for, and it can be a print on demand book out of Amazon. You know, there's a lot of good things to be said about print on demand now. It, you know, the quality standards are there. And if you don't think that your book, you know, you can sell thousands of copies, well, there's no sense in printing thousands and paying for them, you know.
And of course, it also ties in very neatly with something that many of my students over the last couple of decades at the University of Lincoln have said when I've asked them, do they prefer the physicality of a book, i.e. something that they can hold in their hand, or their e-reader, etc. And generally, I can see Jessica nodding, they still prefer the physicality. That's very much there as opposed to the portability. Jessica, both Rita and Sandy are in Texas. I suspect it's a no-brainer they'll be able to answer the dietary question and the nutrition question that is critical. But who knows? They might surprise us. Jessica, over to you.
Yes, I feel like you'll definitely get at least one of these. But I would love to know if you have ever tried. And if you have, do you like sweet tea and boiled peanuts, which are, of course, favorite snacks from my home state in North Carolina?
So,
I'm sorry, Jeff, I didn't understand. Do we like
sweet tea or boiled peanuts?
Okay, so no to the sweet tea. I'm diabetic, so I don't need sweet tea. But absolutely yes to the boiled peanut. Love boiled peanut. I'm from Florida originally. So,
excellent.
So boiled peanuts are very popular in Florida as well as North Carolina. Not so much in Texas. We don't have places you can just on the side of the road stop and buy, you know.
Exactly. That's what I always say. I've been telling Alex and everyone else that it's the roadside ones. That's where the best peanuts are.
It is.
That's true. Well, I've always been a no sweet tea. You know, I'd like to know who it was that started the sweet tea stuff. Undoubtedly, it had to be a marketing ploy, or, you know, it wouldn't have gotten as far as it, you know, they ask when you order tea, sweet tea or without.
It's very popular in the South, I think, sweet tea.
It's tempting. It's really tempting, though. I mean, I don't know. They're very good marketing.
And it is important that it ticks another box in terms of our author and publishers of the week scenario that's actually there. One of these days, I'm sure we'll publish a book on the dietary and nutritional habits of authors globally and how much they actually appreciate sweet tea or indeed boiled peanuts. Anyway, let's move back to what we're here to talk about primarily, which is the Fire and Embers Book Awards. As you say, it's a combination with, of course, Amy Ravichandran with us as well from that point of view, also Dina Ray. So, you know, clearly in terms of dates, people listening to this effectively have until the end of May, May 31st, to do the early registration. The final deadline is a little bit more forgiving, September the 30th. So I suppose technically, could somebody who's listening to this actually get their book published and then sort of enter it? Or is that a case of, no, that's ridiculous. That's far too ambitious. They should have already been in print now.
Well, I've actually heard from two different people who said, my book's not going to be ready before July. Is that going to be okay? And I said, yeah, that's fine. As long as you get it to us by the 30th of September, we're good. You just get a little discount if you get in early.
And in terms of genre, because clearly that's one of the other sort of aspects that we have conventions for science fiction folk. We were at one literally a week or so ago. We have crime and thriller conventions and so on. There are romantic conventions and so on. Is there a particular genre that you personally prefer, or is it a case of, no, even if it's documentary, if it's autobiographical, as long as it's a book that's actually there, that's what we're looking for?
How about you, Sandy?
Well, we have, I think, within the fiction category, we have about 30 different ones. And I think every one that you mentioned, Alex, is one of the ones that's included, plus others. Poetry is included. And then we have the nonfiction books as well. And I don't know, do we have more than one category in nonfiction, or is that just a category?
Well, I've never really divided them out. I think it's probably about even the nonfiction and the fiction.
Okay.
But we have 42 different categories that you can enter in. And you can enter in more if you think, You know, you have something that might appeal to two different categories, you know, two different genres, then, you know, you can enter both.
Rita, you're talking about genre hybridization there. It could be a whole new area that we could be exploring, a kind of chimera of genres. You don't know what could be emerging on that basis. You could have the detective story and the cyberpunk novel on the same thing.
And I think we probably do have some of those as well.
Yeah, especially in mystery and true crime. And I think there's three or four that deal with something, you know, that has to do with mystery or crime.
And of course, there's an awful lot of crossover between horror, fantasy, and science fiction. Those three do tend to coalesce in a whole range of ways and manners. Jessica, any other questions from yourself?
I have to ask, I mean, maybe you don't want to say, but do you have a favorite genre yourself of what you like to read just in your free time? Maybe not with judging, but just what you like to read.
So my go ahead, Dina.
No, go ahead, sweetie.
Mine is cozy mysteries. I love a good mystery, but I don't want all the blood and guts and all of that. So I really do like a mystery.
I can sense, Sandy, a certain Miss Marple element coming across with respect to
right,
yourself.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Kind of combination combination of Miss Marple and maybe Angela Lansbury's Jessica Fletcher, perhaps. That's
yes,
one.
Absolutely.
Rita.
As for me, I'm an ancient history buff. I have a lot of friends that are archaeologists and, you know, that sort of thing. If I probably have close to 10,000 books in my house right now, and I bet there's not more than 50 to 100 that are actual fiction. I want to be learning something, you know, not reading about someone else's experiences and having that has a voyeur aspect to it. I want to be learning something if I'm going to read.
Well, arguably,
if you can look behind me, you'll see that I have my bookcase there, and it is completely full. Plus, I have boxes underneath the credenza back there. That, but I have to say that most of mine are fiction, and I have some, you know, first editions and things like that. I absolutely love books and have loved books my entire life. So I love to read.
And in terms of, say, the market, of course, the other category, which I suppose is also growing substantially and almost exponentially, is that of the Audible, the podcast, Audible books on air, and the audio versions of books. Will that form possibly something you might consider as well in terms of how easily adapted would this book be to an audio format?
Well, when we first started putting together the different ramifications of what we wanted in it, we thought about audio, and we thought for the first year, we probably got enough on our plate. Let's wait for audio until next year. But definitely we've got an award for the best trailer. So it just makes sense to come in with audiobooks next year.
And then I like the idea of the ebook too, Rita, as Alex was saying, because in reading some of the things on independent publishing, for an author, an ebook is probably the most profitable thing they can do because they don't have the cost of printing and the other. So I think maybe next year we add ebooks to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
But Rita, why don't you just take a minute about the Ember card? So it's the Fire and Embers. The Fire Book Award is those books published this year, 2024. But what is the Embers, Rita?
The Embers are books published between 2019 and 2023. There are some books out there that are fantastic books. They just have not received the recognition that they need. So if you've got a book that was published between 2019 and 2023, and you want to enter the competition, we have awards for those too.
It sounds absolutely fantastic, as we knew it would from that perspective. It's, of course, the Fire and Ember Book Awards, let's be precise, or Embers Book Awards. You can access, of course, the mainline website with respect to firebookawards.com. You can even use the email to contact admin@firebookawards.com. Got to ask the question, the social media, always is out there in terms of TikTok, in terms of Instagram, in terms of various other things. I appreciate TikTok might well be banned in the United States shortly, so maybe we won't talk too much about TikTok.
Yeah.
Do you intend to have a presence that obviously sort of echoes the growing world of Facebook, Instagram, and such like?
Yes, we definitely do the social media aspect of it. And Rita and I are doing more the LinkedIn, Facebook type of publicity, while Amy and Dina are the two younger ones in the mix. And they're doing the videos for TikTok and those kind of things. But their Instagram, all those go to the younger group.
Well, I was very impressed, Sandy, that literally 10 minutes before the interview, you sent me a LinkedIn request, which I'm sure I will respond to the positive and affirmative.
Well, I didn't know if you would even see it or not, but when I saw that you were on LinkedIn and saw some of the things and how you had been doing the broadcasting for like over 50 years, did it say? Like,
well, 40. We haven't quite reached the 50th
oh, 40,
yet.
Okay,
but,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm like, oh my gosh. So you have a very impressive LinkedIn. I was wanting to say that.
Well, thank you, Sandy. It's been terrific connecting with your good self today. We have two final questions, and I think I'll ask the first one and Jessica can ask the second. The first one is, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today? Rita, has it been good for you once you got unmuted?
It has. Yes, it has, once I got unmuted.
Good. Sandy, same question.
Absolutely, it has. And to tell you the truth, this morning I'm like, okay, so Zoom probably means this is a video podcast, not an audio. So that means I have to put makeup on. Very pleasant experience, Alex. I've enjoyed it very much.
Well, we do take some screenshots, but the bulk of the whole piece will be audio, so you don't have to worry too much with respect to that. So that's the key thing. Anyway, otherwise Jessica would not be outside. She'd have a whole hair and makeup team. And just, you know, there'd be a whole range of things that would go on that system. Anyway, Jessica, final question for Rita and Sandy, please.
Yes. Will you both join us again soon?
For sure. Have us back anytime.
Oh, absolutely. And maybe you guys, we're part of Amy has the Author Talk podcast. So I don't know, Alex, if you've been on her podcast or not, but I would love to invite you. I was one of the original three that started that podcast about almost 10 years ago. And it's now one of the number one podcasts for indie publishing authors. So we'd love to have one or both of you on at any time.
I'm sure we'd be delighted. At least I would be delighted. I'm sure Jessica's nodding as well. So great stuff.
Yes,
there.
Definitely. Definitely.
Upcoming, we'll be speaking to Paul Scott from the Joseph Banks Museum in Horncastle about flooding issues and so on. But for the moment, to Rita Mills and to Sandy Lawrence and, of course, to Jessica Burtis, huge thanks indeed. And very best of luck with these awards. I know they're going to be excited, and we look forward to hopefully following the narrative through as the award sort of builds to a climax.
And Alex, the books are available internationally. So books from the UK are invited to be entered as well.
The UK right now stands as our number one out of the United States people who have come to the website. So the info's getting out there one way or the other.
It's the magic of the word, which is always important, because after all, in the beginning was the word. Oh no, that's another book entirely. And we'll go into a different line on that one completely.
This is Siren Radio. What a scenario without Siren Radio. Turn up everyone, save a siren sound. Keep on keeping on. Siren Radio.
listening to Siren Radio, and we have a very special guest that's actually joining us now. He has joined us in the past, but we're always delighted to welcome the chairman of the Joseph Banks Museum in Horncastle, of course. That's the awesome Paul Scott. How are you, Paul?
I'm good. I'm good, thank you, Alex. Yeah, I hate when somebody starts like that, though. Awesome. I've got to climb a mountain now, haven't I?
Not at all. I know you are, and I know you'll be able to cope with that, because I was fortunate enough with one of our other co-presenters, Kathy Manso, to have a little location report. I think a little over a year ago, basically, when we were privileged to actually see the Joseph Banks Museum in action, so to speak. And let's just start off with that, because there is a couple of good news stories, and we've also got, well, there are a couple of good news stories. We've also got some news about the environment, etc. But just share with us briefly, and the listener who isn't aware, about the Joseph Banks Museum, why it's such an important part of the Horncastle environment.
Well, I suppose we should start with Joseph Banks. I mean, he was a naturalist, but he was into everything, and he was very significant in terms of his contributions to Lincolnshire. You've only got to think about canals, turnpike roads, transport, all those sorts of things, local health. He was a beneficiary of a dispensary in Horncastle, and so it goes on. So a huge benefactor to both Horncastle and to the county. But bringing him into today in terms of relevance, the society came to a crossroads during COVID, actually, where we had to close our shops. We had a couple of gift shops downstairs. Many people who are listening will probably remember that. But along came COVID, they had to be closed. So we had to, oh, I hate this word, we had to pivot. Oh, God, how awful. We had to move ourselves into a different direction. We'd already got collections, not extensive, but we'd got collections relating to Joseph Banks. So we decided to start a natural history, natural science centre. There was a couple of reasons for that. One, Joseph Banks did that. Soho Square was a natural science centre in its day. And we wanted to mirror our collections against the collections of Joseph Banks, except we didn't want to collect human remains, because that's a different kettle of fish altogether. Banks had shrunken heads, and there was no way we're going down that road. So apart from that, we decided to develop our collections. But the second reason is, I'm not sure people realise this, it's very, very difficult, particularly in the county, to actually find natural science collections, natural history collections. They're difficult. They're difficult to deal with, Alex. They're difficult to curate. They're difficult to look after. You need expertise. You need the right conditions. And so consequently, when museums are looking to cut costs, as they are increasingly in today's world, those types of collections go first, because they're expensive to look after, and you need a certain skill set to be able to do that. So it's no accident that you won't find many natural science collections either in the county or even in the East Midlands. There are a few, but not many. I mean, back in the day, every county museum had a natural science, natural history section. You can't find them now. So there was a gap, and the gap, as far as we could see, was it's about connecting people, and particularly young people, to the natural world and the world around them. And we think that's a missing piece of the jigsaw in terms of education, and that's where we try to focus. That's the direction we're heading. We're not there yet. We've only been going 3 years. So come on, give us a break. But that's the direction we're heading.
Which is excellent news, of course, for lovers of history and natural history in particular from that point of view, and obviously appreciators of the legacy of Joseph Banks. So does the recent award of up to 3,500, which has been awarded to 36 new projects across the UK by the Royal Society Places of Science grants, is that going to help the overall aims of the Joseph Banks Society? And could you just share with us what the award, and congratulations, of course, for that, will actually help to do?
Well, I think it will, Alex. And I think for a number of reasons. It's not the money. although the money's going to be used for a very worthwhile project, which I'll share with you shortly, it's the fact we've joined this sort of exclusive, and there's only 36 in the country, so a pretty exclusive group of organizations who are working on this sort of citizen science projects with the Royal Society. And if you think that Banks was president of the Royal Society for 41 years, that'll never be surpassed. So there's a massive piece of connectivity there for us, for the society, and for entering the world of the grown-ups, as it were. But so yes, we will get an enormous amount of support from the Royal Society, and the very fact that we're working with them will boost our profiling greatly. So yeah, all good on that. In terms of the project, a Horncastle lad and a contemporary of Joseph Banks, Richard Hill. Richard Hill, amazingly, was attended Horncastle Grammar School in around 1805, something like that. He was born in Jamaica, so he was and he was born to an English father and a Caribbean mother, so he was a person of color. Which was pretty unusual in sort of 1790, 1795 in Jamaica. And incredibly, his family sent him over to Horncastle Grammar School for his education. And so he spent his formative years in Horncastle, at around the same time as Joseph Banks would have been walking the streets. And so, what luck. But the really, really important thing about Hill is that when he went back to Jamaica, his task given to him by his dying father on his deathbed was to try and make a difference to the dreadful slaves and emancipation, all the rest of it in Jamaica. And that's what he spent the rest of his life doing. And you know, he is revered almost in Jamaica as one of the founders of the country. He went on to become a privy councillor, and get this, he was also a naturalist, and he contributed to books on ornithology and the birds of Jamaica. He also was a botanist. He was into plants, so it really fits with Banks and Horncastle and the story. And we're going to together with the University of Lincoln, we're going to do a research project to learn more about Hill, and we'll use those funds to do that. We'll work with the colleagues in Jamaica to get as much information about this chap as possible, because a real worthy of both Horncastle and Lincolnshire.
Excellent, and certainly look forward to that. I can see the various Netflix and streaming services biting at your door already to actually say we want the rights to this fabulous individual. I'm sure it would work well. There must be a series in there. 6th of July to the 28th of September this year, there's a exhibition that's going on, which is very much a mixture of both historical and contemporary, and hopefully indeed future in certain ways. It's called We're in Hot Water. It's at the Joseph Banks Centre, Natural Science and Local Heritage. Share with us what it connects with in terms of flooding, which clearly, unless we want to go back to the days where the fens and so on were completely underwater, could be problematic for the future geography of the country.
Yes, it could, and it probably will. But I'll get back to that. Let's start with local first. It's no accident that Horncastle over the centuries has become flooded loads and loads of times. We sit between two rivers, for goodness sake, the River Bain and the Wearing, and clearly over history there's been events, you know, weather events that have meant that the town's flooded. And the last major flood, I'm talking major, was in the 1960. But of course, we had some major flooding last October, where you know, I don't know the exact numbers, but sort of probably over 100 or 100 or so homes were flooded, and caused enormous damage and upset and anguish and cost for people. And people still Some people still, their lives have been disrupted by those floods last October. So we want to reflect on that in terms of the local flooding and why that takes place, our geographic position, the rivers, and perhaps look at things that might be possible to help with that situation. So that's the first part of it. So that's very much the local bit. Then what we want to do is we want to look at flooding in other places in the world. And the Bank Society are very lucky that we have connections with the island nation of Vanuatu. And we've got connections with a school out there. And we're also connected to them via the Melanesian Mission. And the Melanesian Mission have been doing work in Vanuatu and the whole of Melanesia, actually, to look at the effect of rising sea levels. So we're not going to the global warming stuff, but we can say definitively that that sea levels are rising, that the indigenous people are having to move off their islands that have been their homes for thousands of years, and even where they're not having to move off their islands, they're losing their crop growing capability because of the flood waters. So their food is having to be brought to them by boat. So that's a fact. And we've got film footage, and we'll have interviews and photographs and things of all of that, what's happening over in Vanuatu. And then we're going to go a full circle, and we're going to come back to Lincolnshire, and we're going to look at what Lincolnshire might look like in the future. Because guess what? Most of South Lincolnshire, at least, is under sea level, as are some of the islands that we've just been talking about. So, just because sea level rising in the South Pacific doesn't mean that's their problem and it won't happen here. Guess what? The seas are connected and it will happen here. It's already happening here. And sea levels will rise. And unless we build more and more defences, then low-lying land will have to be, I don't like to use the word sacrifice, but I can't think of another way of doing it. Of course, large conurbations, I've no doubt that, sea defences will protect them. But open areas like the Wash, how on earth can you do that? I don't see how you can do it. And people as eminent as the University of Lincoln's Professor Simon Pearson is already talking about in his some of his lectures, a reflooding of the Fen. So that brings us back to Banks again, doesn't it? And he was one of the main people that was responsible for draining the Fen. So you can see how the exhibition goes into a full circle, and Banks jumps in and out of it every now and again. But we think it'll be interesting. We don't want it to be too negative. We want people to come and visit the exhibition to learn about what's going on locally, internationally, and what might happen in the future. But we also want to give them things to take away, little things that they can that might help. Because everybody says, don't they? Oh yes, but we can't do anything about it. Well, if enough of those did little bits, then it would make a little bit of difference, and in some cases, perhaps a lot. So people can do things, and the worst thing we could do is send them all away feeling depressed and powerless and not able to make a difference. So we're looking to develop or give people tricks, not tricks, things that they can do that might
Suggestions.
help. Yeah, suggestions that they might be able to do.
Well, it's been terrific connecting with yourself. If people want to come along to the museum between the 6th of July and 28th of September, will they be able to actually see a full exhibition which addresses some of these challenges?
Yes, they will.
Excellent.
I mean, at the end of the day, our other collections will be available if people want to see them. If people want to see some of the plant collections that we've got, we can take them to show those. I mean, they'll not be out on display, but people can have a look at them. There's other things to see. The garden, of course, is always nice in the summer to come and visit. And so is Horncastle, by the way. Horncastle's a great place. It doesn't flood very often in the summer, so people can be quite safe about parking their car near the rivers in the riverside car parks and having a pleasant day in Horncastle.
And horncastlejbc.info, presumably the website to actually access for further information.
I wouldn't go on that, Alex. No, I would stick to the main society website, which is
Okay.
www.joseph-banks.org.uk. That's the one that's most up to date.
The role of the entrepreneur, absolutely essential in the 21st century, as it was actually in the 20th century. But how do we actually keep ahead of the curve? Do we have a time machine? Do we actually use the I Ching to actually predict the future? How do we actually see these trends as they develop? Well, we're delighted to welcome to the program an ace entrepreneur herself, the co-founder of Green and Blacks. It's the awesome Jo Fairley. How are you, Jo?
I'm very good. Thank you, Alex. Thanks for that lovely intro.
Well, it's great to connect with your good self. Now, this particular survey, which ties in obviously with Virgin Business and so on, as a consultant to many leading businesses, is this something which you thought, yes, the Virgin Media O2 Business Movers Index does suggest some key trends in the marketplace?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the really important things in business as an entrepreneur, you spend so much time dealing with the day to day that you don't often get the chance to stand back and see where your business sits in a wider landscape. And so the incredibly detailed data coming out of something like this report, this index, is just invaluable and gives you that moment to see, well, you know, which way is the wind blowing from a retail perspective. And of course, you know, I mean, there's that t-shirt you can buy that says, I shop, therefore I am, because shopping says so much about who we are and what we're interested in. We do shop with our, you know, we vote every day with our pound about where we want to spend our money. So it was really fascinating to me to sit down and see some of the stats that have come out of this index.
We obviously have reached Generation Alpha, I believe. They're obviously impacting the workplace and so on. But you might also say the TikTok generation are with us, whether or not, of course, the platform is banned in the United States. People be heavily influenced by social media. There's been a lot of talk about this over the years, Joe, in terms of where do you put your money in? Do you put your money in to advertise? Does it actually pay dividends? What's the return on investment, etc.? Does this suggest that actually, yeah, if you've got a decent TikTok video or an Instagram presence and so on, it can certainly influence the choices that consumers are making?
Well, I think so. One of the stats that came out of the index was that 69% of businesses have leveraged social media trends. And what that has led to is actually a 78% improvement in their business performance. So it really can't be ignored. But at the same time, I think the stats that really encouraged me out of this report, which is free, it's quarterly, anybody can download it, are the fact that at the same time, 57% of us still believe our local high streets are really important. And one of the most gripping facts for me was that 48% plan to increase their local spending, which is kind of counterintuitive when you hear all this stuff about social media and online, etc. But I think is a reflection of the fact that as our lives become more digital and as we spend more time on our devices, we kind of crave a balance to that. And we want to go into a bakery. I mean, I'll tell you a story, but we had a bakery, my husband and I, on our street, and I made a point of trying to learn which kind of loaf every customer liked, as well as their name. And I still walk down the street going, "Hello, Prue. Hello, Mrs. Flippance." And my husband will sometimes say, "How do you know that person?" And I go, "Well, I not only know her name, but I know she likes a burnt bloomer." And you can't get that online. I mean, so we need those personal touches. We crave those personal touches, and that's what you get from local. And you know, we also know that when you spend money locally, it tends to circulate locally. It doesn't go to some great big HQ in America or China or wherever. It stays in the community. So that for me was really put a smile on my face.
People's concern about wellness and well-being seem to be very much to the fore here. A quarter of us are planning to spend more on wellness and self-care, and approximately again 26% looking to cut back on alcohol purchases. So I suppose good news for well-being entrepreneurs, etc., but not so much good news if you're into alcohol.
Well, I am a well-being entrepreneur as well. So this was another of the stats from the Virgin Media O2 Business Movers Index, which really chuffed me because my husband and I also own a well-being centre that we opened in 2008. And we've never seen footfall like we've seen in the last few months or so. And I think that's a reflection of the fact that we live in quite a scary, frightening, uncertain world that feels like it's, you know, changing by the day. And the only way we can deal with that really satisfactorily is to build our own resilience and to find a personal blueprint for wellness that enables us to be the calm at the centre of the storm while it's swirling all around us. So yeah, that's something I'm seeing from my own business, but it was something I was really heartened to read. It's not just a, you know, local blip down here, but actually is nationwide.
And in terms of people wishing to find out further details, Jo, about this particular quarterly survey, you mentioned it's really easy and accessible to find. Where would you point them?
Go to the Virgin Media O2 business website and search for the Virgin Media O2 Business Movers Index, or just use good old Google to find either of those. I think you'll have some riveting reading and at the very least something to wow your friends with stat-wise in the pub.
Well, I have to say, Jo, as the co-founder of Green and Black, so I have to point out to the listener that you're even wearing a green and black outfit, which we can see. So I'm very impressed that you're actually on message all the way on that particular side of things, which is very good to see.
Thank you. It's a bit like the school uniform. What can I say?
Well, of course. And how can people actually follow your good self via the socials?
I am at Jo Fairley on Instagram, and I love doing it. I wish I'd had that tool at the beginning of my business journey.
Well, Jo, it's been awesome connecting with your good self as ever. Keep on keeping on and continue your excellent entrepreneurship.
Thanks very much.
Siren Radio.
What a scenario without Siren Radio. Stand up, everyone, save our siren sound. From Lincoln to Miami, Paris to LA, our global community wants to hear it play.
Siren Radio.
Let them all create, students participate. Keep on keeping on, save our siren radio.